If they continually sue Native people in court over our inherent and God-given rights, will we vote for them?
Julie Kitka has harsh words for Governor Parnell at AFN. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 23rd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, criticism for the state's effort to allow for public input for management of state lands.
Pretty much anyone who comes in with a permit to do pretty much anything will be told to go out there and do whatever they want to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A small unmanned fuel barge is adrift in the Beaufort Sea and may be heading toward Prudhoe Bay after its tow line snapped in a storm on Monday. The 134-foot barge has 950 gallons of diesel fuel on board. It's owned by a Canadian company and was in Canadian waters when it broke loose from its tugboat. Now, Coast Guard Response Commander Sean Decker estimates the barge is drifting west in ice-free water at a speed of 3 to 4 miles an hour. At that rate, he says it could reach Prudhoe Bay sometime late tomorrow, and there aren't any vessels nearby that could try to stop it. Decker says it's not guaranteed the barge will run aground in Prudhoe Bay. It's drifting between the Arctic coastline and winter sea ice advancing from the north. The Coast Guard wasn't able to visually locate the barge today, so they don't know for sure where it's drifting or how fast. Decker says a Coast Guard aircraft will find the vessel again tomorrow and drop a tracking device onto its deck. The head of Alaska's largest Native organization publicly criticized Governor Sean Parnell Thursday morning, the opening day of the Alaska Federation of Natives convention in Anchorage. AFN President Julie Kitka called the governor out during her president's report to the convention, which immediately followed Parnell's remarks. Parnell was not in the audience at the time. He was in a different room at the Dena'ina Center to sign a bill making Alaska's Native languages official languages of the state. Kitka said the Parnell administration used lawsuits to try to shift the balance between the federal and state governments over management of subsistence.
19 years of litigation. 19 years you've heard year after year at the convention about this. This is a victory we have earned through a conscious and powerful defense of our rights as a people, and we should all be proud. On a side note, I have a question to you. The political candidates are asking for your vote. Does it matter what their position on subsistence is? If they continually sue Native people in court over our inherent and God-given rights, will we vote for them? Just want to know.
The focus of Parnell's remarks at last year's convention was digital learning. This year, he talked about the state's efforts to work with tribal courts.
We listened to what Alaskans said about the need for culturally accepted remedies. We said we must protect the constitutional rights of all, and you said there must be a way to increase tribal involvement. And we said we will find that way together. We will work with you, and we will continue to do so for as long as it takes, because justice is a journey and healing the prize.
The state of Alaska intervened in a case earlier this year challenging a tribal court's authority to extinguish the parental rights of a person who is not a member of their tribe. In the Simmons versus Parks case, the Minto Tribal Court terminated the parental rights of Bessie Stearman, a Minto tribal member, and Edward Parks, a member of the Stevens Village tribe. Just months before the termination, Parks had beaten Stearman badly enough that she suffered 3 broken ribs and a collapsed lung. The state asserted that it was trying to protect the constitutional rights of Parks. The The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is revising management plans for some of the most exceptional areas of wildlife habitat in the state. But critics say that even after an outcry about what's been called a massive erosion in environmental protection by both the public and the legislature, little to nothing has been fixed. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
The Habitat Division within ADF&G oversees the 32 so-called special areas. They're state lands like McNeil River Game Sanctuary and Eisenbeck Refuge, supporting wildlife from brown bears all the way to sandhill cranes. Randy Bates is the head of the Habitat Division and says they're hoping to release the first batch of 8 revised management plans in the next 1 to 2 months.
At the end of the day, what we want is a plan that protects and preserves the area, the natural habitats, the populations of fish and game, for the reasons these areas were designated.
Once those drafts are finished by ADF&G employees, they'll be made available for a public review lasting about 45 days.
And that'll give the public an opportunity to review that informally, see the changes that we're proposing, and that we'll have an opportunity for a public meeting in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks.
The informal review process is a way for Bates and his staff to hear concerns and recommendations for specific plans, but in a way that's less constrained by protocol than under the Administrative Procedures Act. But Rick Sinnott, who worked within Habitat early on in his 28-year career with Fish and Game, says the division used to draft each plan by identifying all stakeholders, from birders to oil companies.
And all year long, those people would be involved in the process. You didn't just say, well, we're going to do this plan and then go into hiding for a year and then come out with the plan and say, well, you got 30 days to review it. And that's what's happening now.
Sinnott is also concerned that the informal commenting and review process isn't legally binding and so doesn't offer the public any meaningful way to decide who will use the special areas and for what.
The conventional wisdom is that these things are going to be changed so much that they're going to be unrecognizable from the previous plans. And the point being, the pressure is to make them as unrestrictive as possible so that pretty much anyone who comes in with a permit to do pretty much anything will be given the permit and told to go out there and do whatever they want to do.
Sinnott's concerns draw on what happened last year at Dude Creek. The Habitat Division released revised plans for the area covered in red ink, cut in half, with environmental regulations and scientific sections totally scrapped. At the time, Bates explained to APRN the cuts were the result of a miscommunication with his staff. But Bob Shavelson, director of Cook Inlet Keeper, a conservation group, says the process fits with a trend coming out of Governor Sean Parnell's administration.
And now here we have our special areas. These are our critical habitat areas, our refuges, our sanctuaries, and the administration is making broad brush changes behind closed doors without public participation. So there's a real concern about the erosion of democracy here and the behind-the-scenes process that's taking place.
Shavelson is circulating a petition that asks the administration to reconsider the state's criteria for managing special areas. He also thinks that even stakeholders with specific concerns about individual areas will have a hard time reviewing so much information in just 45 days.
When all these plans come out at one time, it's going to be like drinking from a fire hose. There's going to be no way for local people to respond meaningfully.
There is no way to get a preview of what the upcoming management plans will look like. The biologists within ADF&G working directly on revisions are not cleared to speak with the public or even employees in different divisions within the department. That's according to a year-old memo sent by Bates to Habitat staff. Bates denies, though, that this amounts to a gag order.
Not much opportunity or need to respond to that. I do look forward to the open public process that we intend to have on these plan revisions.
While ADF&G does not have a set date for releasing its revised management plans and thus kicking off the 45 days of public review, Bates says the department will publicize the information as soon as possible. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the string of unusual earthquakes near Minto.
Something in the Minto region isn't quite settled yet. We've had now 3 earthquakes of comparable size in less than 2 months.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Raven, Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven, Alaska, soaring above.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
U.S. Senate candidates Mark Begich and Dan Sullivan sparred today over who can better move Washington to bring more resource development to Alaska. The Anchorage debate was sponsored by the Resource Development Council and associations representing the state's oil and gas, mining, and logging industries. Sullivan, sticking to his main campaign strategy, repeatedly tied Begich to President Obama and the Senate's Democratic leader, Harry Reid. Sullivan says the Democrats want to impede resource development with regulations, lawsuits, and by blocking legislation.
And what I'll do as a U.S. Senator is follow on what I did as the DNR Commissioner. Work with people, all the stakeholders, to recognize we have a problem, bipartisan support, and I'm very interested in being on the Environment and Public Works Committee to do exactly what we need to do. Really reform our regulatory and permitting system to unleash the economic and energy potential of Alaska and America.
Senator Begich insists the election is not about Obama. He says Alaska is closer to new logging opportunities with the Sea Alaska Land Bill, which he says is ready to go to the Senate floor. He says development of the National Petroleum Reserve is progressing, as is Arctic Ocean drilling. Begich says he's been able to promote resource extraction with his committee assignments.
When you elect someone like Dan Sullivan, here's what we do lose. Seniority does matter. How many times did you have before Ted Stevens standing up here talking about seniority? It makes a difference in the United States Senate. And when you're on the Appropriations Committee, two seats from a state, very rare.
At the end, debate organizers polled the audience on whether the forum would influence their vote. Most respondents said it would not. Late last week, U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan took his campaign to Bethel. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more on the challenger to Senator Mark Begich, who, if successful, may be the senator that tilts the power balance in the Senate from Democratic to Republican.
On a clear and chilly Friday afternoon at the Alaska Territorial Guard Park, Senate candidate Dan Sullivan walks along the Wall of Honor and asks Tondi Rogers about the names of those who served.
Is that your uncle?
My stepdad's over there, and I got cousins in the Eek, Quinnahawk, Good News, Hooper Bay, down near the whole wall.
Boy,
I used to know
proud tradition.
Wearing his combat boots, the lieutenant colonel in a Marine Corps reserve unit was getting the face-to-face contact with potential voters that many say is essential to success in rural Alaska. Retail politics, of course, is one voter at a time. Buck Bukowski is wearing a button that reads "Yupik" for Begich.
I'm going to try and convince you to change buttons.
I don't know.
Friday's visit marked Sullivan's first to the YK Delta in over a year of campaigning. The rhetoric, however, between the two campaigns has already reached a shrill pitch on rural issues. Sullivan alleges that incumbent Senator Mark Begich has been saying that he has the Native vote
locked up,
a statement that Begich spokesperson Max Crows says his boss has never made. It's ugly on both sides. The Begich campaign has positioned Sullivan as an adversary to subsistence users, tribes, and rural Alaska. Sullivan, however, is quick to defend his rural cred.
I have very deep ties with the Alaska Native community that go much deeper than my opponents because they're family. And my daughters are Alaska Native girls. And my wife is Alaska Native. And what we're doing is we're going around the state with a great leadership team. I am very proud to have some of the most prominent Alaska Native and rural leaders in the state, all different parts of the state, supporting the Sullivan campaign.
Begich has said repeatedly that this race will be decided in rural Alaska and has opened 16 field offices. That presence was apparent at a Bethel Chamber of Commerce lunch where Democratic staff sat in the back and a tracker with a national group working to elect Democratic candidates videotaped Sullivan's every word looking for a slip-up or material to be used in ads. After a stump speech focusing on low-cost energy, reducing federal overreach, improving public safety, and dealing with the salmon crisis, Sullivan heard directly from Bethel residents. In the first question, John Wallace said he was disappointed that Sullivan did not attend the Association of Village Council Presidents conference earlier this month.
Didn't get an invitation, so
you know, you kind of, but we're here, right? And we're here, and I'm here. She was here at that event for the very reason you mentioned, to get out, talk to people.
She was Sullivan's wife, Julie Fate Sullivan. Dan Sullivan planned to travel to Hoover Bay and Aniak over the weekend to shake as many hands of potential voters as possible, along with Senator Lisa Murkowski, who's endorsed him. Sharon Chakuchin attended Sullivan's lunch. She says not knowing the extent of Sullivan's involvement in the Katie John lawsuit, which the state appealed when he was attorney general, gave her pause.
We just heard that term Katie John, and it just strikes a chord in your heart. Oh my gosh, Katie John, that's terrible. So I figured we need to hear the other side of it. We have to know what that's about.
Sullivan says he was just doing his job to protect state sovereignty, but says he supports the federal rural subsistence priority. But his opponents consider the decades-long lawsuit an attack on rural and Alaska Native subsistence rights. Both campaigns are proudly listing prominent rural and Alaska Native endorsements. Sullivan planned to campaign in Aniak with former state representative Carl Morgan.
I think that, and I know that he's going to do a lot of plus for Bush Alaska.
Sullivan says if he's elected, he'll forge a new relationship between the region and federal government and work to bring opposing sides together to fix the subsistence system.
One of the things that I'm a big, big proponent of is sitting down with all the different stakeholders, hearing them out, and trying to get common ground to move forward. Can we do that on subsistence? I think so.
Election day is November 4th. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
20 Alaska Native languages are now official languages in the state of Alaska after Governor Sean Parnell signed House Bill 216 into law this morning at the Alaska Federation of Natives Conference. In a packed room at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage, nearly two dozen elders sat front and center as the governor and a handful of legislators spoke to the importance of the bill. The lawmakers spoke to the inspiration for the bill and how it was long overdue. Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins of Sitka sponsored the legislation.
This seemed like an imperative in our state, in that, languages are our cultural DNA. They're our way of understanding the world, relating to the world, and the extinction of a language is an immeasurable loss to a culture in a very fundamental way, and it demanded action.
But it was the assembled speakers, teachers, and students of nearly all of those 20 Alaska Native languages who spoke to the vitality of what the recognition means. Lance Hignay-Twitchell, an associate professor at UAF Southeast, began in Tlingit before switching to English.
We have suffered so much with these languages. So I ask you to fight for your languages. Once that pen hits the paper, it's a new day. There's no such thing as language superiority, just as there's no such thing as racial superiority. That's what we're saying today.
Ceremonial pens used to sign the bill into law were given out to the assembled elders, with each taking a moment to speak to what the new law means for them, their language, and their communities. Gnomes Bernadette Yakuk Alvana Stimfley, who served on the Alaska Native Language Preservation Advisory Council, says the new law finally puts speakers of all languages on an even field.
And that means the English speakers are now even with the UPEL speakers.
As each of the assembled elders spoke, nearly all agreed that the recognition of their languages was just one step in an ongoing march. Many echoed sentiments of taking the next step in that march by installing the newly recognized languages into state education programs and in universities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
There was another strong earthquake followed by dozens of aftershocks in the interior today. A magnitude 5 earthquake at 8:30 a.m. was centered in the Minto area northwest of Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bras reports, there have been no reports of damage, but the quake, the latest in a series in the same area, has drawn concern from seismologists.
The Thursday morning quake was similar in location, depth, and strength to earthquakes that occurred Monday and on August 30th. State seismologist Michael West says it's hard to consider this latest quake as an aftershock of the August 30th event.
To have one follow-on earthquake that's as big, that gets our attention but is within the norm. At this point, I think it's a clear indication that something out in the Minto region isn't quite settled yet. We've had now 3 earthquakes of comparable size in less than 2 months.
West says it may be similar to a series of 5 strong earthquakes earlier this year in the no-attack area of northwest Alaska. He says the public should be prepared for the potential of more activity in the Minto area, where a 6.5 earthquake occurred in 1995.
This is tricky territory. I don't want to be a fearmonger, but at the same time, we know that the Minto region is capable of larger earthquakes. In 1995, earthquake was about 100 times as energetic. We have no evidence that that's going to happen, but I think we need to allow for the distant possibility of a larger earthquake in the near future.
West says the Thursday morning quake was felt strongly around the interior.
Perhaps this earthquake had a kind of vibration that was more a little more jarring or a little more abrupt on people. I would caution you that those observations are anecdotal only, but I've actually heard that from several different individuals now.
West says while there have been numerous aftershocks, they have not been as intense as those which followed the August 30th earthquake. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A federal grand jury indicted a Wrangell doctor yesterday on child pornography charges. KSTK's Katarina Sostarek reports.
The grand jury charged Wrangell doctor Greg Szilard with 2 felonies for distribution and possession of child pornography. Federal law enforcement officers arrested him last week after executing a search warrant at his residence. The indictment alleges Szilard was in possession of child pornography on the day of his arrest. A Federal Bureau of Investigation agent alleges in an affidavit that Szilard was also making child pornography available to others through a file-sharing network. Szilard is one of 4 medical providers in Wrangell. He's employed as a family doctor by Alaska Island Community Services and serves under a contract with Wrangell Medical Center, the community's hospital. AICS Executive Director Mark Walker says both organizations suspended Szilard's medical privileges after the arrest.
We know that he's been charged, but we know nothing more. We don't know what his pleading is going to be in the outcome of the case. But at this point, he's, you know, not practicing for us or for the hospital.
Walker says he found no reason in the workplace to suspect Szilard would be arrested for child pornography.
There were never any complaints that relate to anything like this. So we're completely taken by surprise by all of this and dismayed about the impact on the community and want to do whatever we can to help anybody that is concerned about it, answer any questions, provide counseling for them.
Szilard started practicing in Wrangell in 2009. Walker stressed that job applicants go through a rigorous hiring process that includes a background check. The hospital suspended Szilard's medical privileges in 2011 and restored them in 2013 after court action and controversy in the community. The state medical board is reviewing the case and may take action on Szilard's medical license in the next few weeks. Szilard is at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau, awaiting his arraignment in U.S. District Court October 28th. At his last court appearance, he requested a public defender and said he had been fired from his job. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katarina Sestarek.
Concerns about Ebola are running high in on Alaska. The town's unique geography and large international workforce has residents wondering how they'd be affected by an outbreak. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, local medical providers are trying to calm those fears.
Un-Alaskans have been seeking reassurance about Ebola anywhere they can find it, from the local clinic to the mayor's office. After weeks of fielding nervous phone calls, the city decided to make their emergency plans clear and remind residents that their risk of contracting Ebola is still pretty low. It's rare to see more than a handful of people turn out for a public meeting in Unalaska, but at Tuesday night's panel on Ebola preparedness, more than 75 people packed into City Hall. The standing room only crowd wanted answers to questions like this.
So somebody says, walk through exactly what the process would be if Ebola hit here now.
That's okay. Ann Nora Arrett, the medical director at the local clinic.
Let's say somebody called up one of the processing safety officers and said, I have a fever and vomiting and diarrhea. Okay, so EMS gets called and you take it from there.
Senior Fire Captain Zach Chastain stepped in to answer for the city's emergency medical volunteers.
As it stands right now, if we had a call tonight, we could respond appropriately to it.
He said dispatchers would ask the caller about their symptoms and recent travel to try to assess the risk of Ebola. Paramedics would try to confirm that on scene by looking for a fever above 101.5 degrees. If they found one, responders would put on their full-body hazmat suits. Chastain says they have gear and training in line with the latest Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines. He says responders would help get the patient into quarantine at the clinic, where a trained staff member would try to rule out other illnesses. But in the end, Arrett says the patient would have to be flown off the island for an official diagnosis. The clinic's game plan is the result of conversations with state and federal health officials, Arrett said. The Coast Guard, commercial medevac companies, and the local tribal clinic have also been consulted. As plans move forward, Arrett asked residents to be conscious of the stigma surrounding Ebola.
We don't want to make assumptions about someone's skin color and label them with being a carrier of infection. So please keep that in mind. And we'll be doing some educational sessions, hopefully, in some of the bigger plants where they have a lot of people coming in together in a small area.
She said she's been keeping up with local processing companies on how they're screening returning workers for signs of illness or risky travel. Some, like Westward and Alyeska Seafoods, conduct physical examinations as they recruit for the next big processing season in January. Meanwhile, Unalaska's biggest processor, Unisi, is screening workers based on travel, too. But their human resources director says they don't typically recruit workers from West Africa, where the outbreak is centered right now. Then there's American Seafoods, which runs offshore processing operations in Unalaska. Arrett said they've asked employees who've been to an affected area to stay home for 30 days before coming to work.
I know they're doing screening in Seattle, and then they plan on also doing screening in Dutch Harbor.
Even if the risk of Ebola is low in Unalaska, Arrett said folks should make sure they're staying healthy in other ways.
If you choose to get a flu shot, this would be a good year to get a flu shot.
And she said people should do their best to prevent the spread of illness. For its part, the clinic's taking no chances. A sign posted on the front door last week tells patients with Ebola-like symptoms to stop outside and call for an escort into the building. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had help tonight from Jenny Canfield, Matt Smith, and Zach Hughes in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Katarina Sestarik in Wrangell, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at crowleyfuels.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes, or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.